Hello, welcome to Coin Talk. I'm Aaron Lammer, to be joined very shortly by my co-host, Jay Kang, back from the road. So much news to cover. I feel like this is the rare episode where we have more than enough to talk about, as opposed to some of our recent episodes where I felt like we were scraping the bottom of the barrel. We're brought to you in partnership with Medium. You can find 11 great features about crypto at read.medium.com/crypto. Let's hear that music.
This episode of Coin Talk was taped Friday, October 19th at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Bitcoin price index was $6,433.
Jay Kang.
How's it going?
Not back in the crypto cave. Not fully immersed in the filth, but probably still a bit filthy.
Yeah, my own private crypto cave, which is my writing office, is actually probably dirtier than the crypto cave.
I think of that office as, like, you know, in New England, how they'll have like a diner, like the Athenian, and then the chain will just be Athenian 2 will be the other one. That's what I think of as, that's crypto cave 2 over there.
Yeah, there's less recording equipment and less tools, and there's a lot more empty space and like general grime on the floor.
Now, when Jay says tools, he's talking literally about tools in the crypto cave. I don't allow tools to come hang out here. That's what you were thinking. I feel like we should just get right to it because we've missed some big, some of our favorite narratives have come roaring back. And I want to tease this episode and say, Jay, lots of people have been asking us to talk about Civil.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
probably our most requested topic.
But I think it's the only thing in crypto that you and I are qualified to have any opinion on. And so it makes sense.
Immediately when we had something to actually offer, we were like, let's not talk about
that. Yeah, exactly. We're like, too close to home. Let's just pontificate and speculate about things we have no idea about and do more of that.
Yeah, like, let's just give more insight into banana coin.
Yeah.
So we're not going to do that now. We're going to do that at the end of the episode because I feel like it's going to get deep and potentially emotional, and we don't want to get too far in right out of the gate. But it feels to me like definitively the sale has failed. So we're not influencing the space-time continuum by talking about Civil now. Like, this is a post-mortem.
Yeah, and you know, just to clarify, it's not like you and I owned any Civil, so that's not our hesitance for talking about it in the past.
No, I think we owned a little bit of journalism soul.
Yeah, and we more just didn't want to talk about it because you and I, between us, know a lot of the people who are involved in the project. We didn't think it would be fair to the listeners or even to them to sort of try for us to try and triangulate what our conflicts of interest and everything would be. But now that everything's over, you know, I think that we can have, you know, we can approach it with the necessary clarity.
And I'll say I'm still confused, but maybe we can collectively pick our way through what ended up being one of the more confusing crypto narratives of the year. That's a surprise in its own right, in my opinion, that we would truly experience our very first coin we knew about would immediately go down in flames.
I'm not so surprised, but you know, it's almost like if 95% of coins go down in flame, why not this one? But
I feel like most coins go down in flames after they raise. I guess I don't know that much about like failed ICOs, and like, it's true, we kind of hear about the silly projects that at least sell their tokens. We don't hear about things that don't even make it to that level.
Yeah.
Do we?
I don't think so.
Before we get to that, our old friend Tether, back in the news. In fact, Jay, just a minute ago, you're like, what happened with Tether? And I was like, I don't know, it's worth like 90 cents, which is both a very casual thing to say and also pretty bonkers.
Yeah, I mean, this was going back way back, you know, like I think even to the basement tapes for us, where Tether was a daily topic of conversation, not just on the show, but, you know, between us, because I think you and I fundamentally disagreed about sort of the insolvency or the problems with Tether. And, you know, at the time there was a very influential Twitter account called Bitfinex that was
still out there, still
yelling about sort of the sky is falling scenarios every like 14 minutes and doing weird YouTube interviews where he disguised his voice. Do you remember we tried to get him on the show and he said he would do it, but he could only use like a voice transmogrifier?
No. You have that story wrong. He said he wouldn't do it because he had had a bad experience with a voice transmogrifier. And I was like, let me build you a great voice transmogrifier. Then he never wrote back.
Oh, okay. Well, we tried to have him on the show as well. But I'm not sure if I would be comfortable saying that everything that he could predicted came true. I mean, crypto did crash and a lot of it was shady. But his main focus was Tether. And he said that the Bitfinex company, which is like an exchange that a lot of Europe and Asia uses, I don't think you're allowed to use it in the United States, that it was improperly using this stablecoin Tether. And now it really does seem like that was happening. No?
In a certain way, it almost doesn't matter if it was happening or not. Like there's a Schrodinger's cat thing, where if the threat that it could be true undermines the entire affair because you couldn't supply the sufficient transparency for people to be convinced. In some ways, that's just as bad as if you were just defrauding people in the first place. Like the threat with Tether wasn't just that what Bitfinex said was true. It was that we would never know because Tether never was going to submit to a real transparent accounting overview audit.
I was about to like say, I don't think that's Schrodinger's cat, but then you brought it around to Schrodinger's cat territory. So good job.
Some of my analogies are both thin and mispronounce the name of the character in it. So
no, I agree. I mean, it was if you can remember back that far. I mean, it feels like 5 years ago in crypto time. But he was demanding that Bitfinex and the Tether company do an audit, and they just didn't. You know, I think they submitted to some fake audit, basically. But
well, I think they commissioned an internal audit, but that had like no binding principles to it.
Yeah.
So it was worthless. And I'll say, so the accusation from Bitfinex was they're using Tether as a money printer.
Yeah.
They print more Tether and buy Bitcoin when the market's going down. And that's basically artificially building up the entire run that, you know, consumed the first half of the show's run. And basically, whenever that's revealed, there's no real buyers for Bitcoin above this point. It's all just Tether money.
Yeah. And, you know, as the days go by, it seems more and more plausible. I mean, I don't think I would say that it's probable, but, you know, he used a lot of sort of weird. Do you remember his videos? He would put these YouTube videos on where he would be showing like a chart as it updated second by second, and he'd play this weird trance music behind, and then he'd like put a bunch of red circles and arrows, and it's like, I actually can't follow this. I'm like, what's going on? What are you arguing, man? But I guess he was just too afraid.
I like, Jay, that it's like a whistleblower comes to find you and you're like, what are you, some kind of a weirdo? Your videos suck.
Well, it's more like, I don't even know what you're blowing the whistle on. Like, what am I looking at here, you know?
Well, so what happened as I perceived it from my Blockfolio account was there was a Tether panic where people started getting out of Tether as quickly as they could. And this in itself was a bit of a surprise to me. It's like, I don't even really understand who's holding Tether. Tether, I always saw Tether as like a leapfrog where you like were trying to get from your dollar to an altcoin, and you needed to be in Tether for like 2 minutes. And I've never used Tether, but if I did use Tether, I would certainly not hold on to it.
I think it's for day traders, right? Like you can't get money in and out of
right.
these exchanges that quickly. And so if you don't want all of your trades to be pegged to Bitcoin, the way to peg it to the US dollar, you know, in the past was to peg it to Tether.
I mean, I keep money in my Coinbase account in US dollars, so I guess I'm just as guilty. But if the one difference was that it said, you know, 500 Tethers instead of 500 US dollars, I would look at that holding very differently.
Yeah, I agree.
And the stablecoin people basically want you to not look at it differently and just be like, this is immutably $1. Don't even worry about it.
Yeah. They just say you should have faith that this is a dollar because in this ecosystem, we declared it was a dollar. And, you know, to their credit, and who knows how this was accomplished, but Tether's been around for a couple of years now. And up until this week, it really was close to a dollar for the entire time. So,
yeah, I mean, it worked until it failed. And look, it could have failed a lot more catastrophically. When I heard about this story, I was expecting Tether to go to like 40 cents. You know, the fact that it even held at 90 cents in crypto terms is not a bad performance.
Well, I mean, I think that goes more to your question of who actually holds it. And who knows, you know, like it went down 10% because people thought that Bitfinex, the exchange, was insolvent. And then they started moving hundreds of millions of dollars of Tether around. And people like, oh, well, this must be the end. And they got out of Tether. But it's impossible to figure out what the actual price of Tether is, you know, because nobody knows who holds it or what it does. And so once again, like if it goes down 10%, that doesn't seem catastrophic, especially in crypto. But we don't actually even know what that means. You know, like it could be that 100% of Tether actual users got out and the price dropped 10% because, you know, like only 2% of all of Tether is actually held for any reason other than fraud. The point is, like, we just don't know.
Here's a fun angle on this, a disturbing fun angle. My understanding is that Tether is a blockchain. I'm sorry to listeners for my deep, deep ignorance, but my understanding is that Tether is a, if not a decentralized coin, a coin tracked on a blockchain.
Yeah, didn't they have to like roll it back at some point or something like that?
Yeah. So one big difference between US dollars and Tether is that when huge amounts of Tether moves, everyone can see it. And that injects a very crazy game theory layer to everything about moving huge amounts of Tether. If we could see all the money moving in and out of the US Treasury and across banks, people would play the game quite differently, I would think.
Yes, but you know, it would have been built up differently as well. So,
I mean, so I think what basically set off the panic was the rumor, or the possibly true rumor, that Bitfinex was covering up for hacks and was basically moving Tether in to cover other losses.
Yeah.
And this is basically like always the FUD around a exchange. It's not this exchange got hacked, but it's this exchange got hacked actually at some point in the near or distant past, and everything that's happened afterwards has been an elaborate cover-up for this hack,
yeah,
which has happened many times.
Well, I was about to say, like, it doesn't seem like a conspiracy or like extreme FUD when this is actually the empirically has been the most probable actual explanation for what's going on. I don't know. I mean, look, at this point, I think that our conclusion is more or less the same, right? Which is that this is feels like another sort of just another confirmation of what seems to be a narrative that you and I, despite our best efforts, can't really deny, which is that a lot of what happened at the end of last year in terms of the price spike and everything like that, it's just very, very hard at this point to reasonably say that a lot of that was real, right? I mean, this just seems to be more confirmation because Bitfinex really did have a large part in pumping up the price just because the volume was so high in trading there.
I mean, you're a little bit more of a truth-oriented person than I am. I think I'm a little bit less convinced than you are that the bull run was all a mirage. But I also come back to it's another Schrodinger's cat situation where if we can't know whether that was a bull run driven by true buyers or by a Tether printer, in sum, it's just as bad as if it was fake, because the public perception, the market's perception is, well, it might have been fake. And that's putting a huge stumbling block between people believing that Bitcoin is ever going to get up to $20,000-ish again.
Yeah, and the other problem is that there's no counter-narrative or evidence that has been presented that it was real, you know, that people really do believe in this thing and that they're just waiting for this stuff to die down. I don't know. I mean, I don't think that it is really particular. This story in itself is particularly damning. just because I think everybody has already written off Bitfinex, the exchange, and, you know, it just seems like so much of what they did was shady. If this was about Coinbase or something like that, I think that would be slightly different, even though not that much different.
Well, Coinbase would never get involved in these hijinks because Coinbase already has a good business. Like, there's no reason to be particularly shady in crypto when you can just charge people fees and convert their change into your own Binance coin. Like, the exchange business is great. If you're insolvent, which it appears Bitfinex may have been close to, it's probably because you've been running a pretty bad business.
Yeah. Yeah. And we will never really know who was running that business out of where or what it was, you know, because they wouldn't tell us. And, you know, the more time goes by, the less people care to figure it out.
Yeah. And I use really dumb pop psychology. You know, like, I feel like we should like have a regular feature on our show, which is like, what would the stupid person do?
Yeah.
Which is like, In the early days, it was like, oh, buy all the Coinbase coins, buy Ripple.
Yeah.
And here's, I'm just going to, because I'm very good at putting myself in the mind of someone stupid, because this is actually how I think. I'm like, if there were real buyers above 6,000, 8,000, 10,000, they would have bought it back up after this crash. And so the fact that Bitcoin is flat ends up serving as evidence of the Kangian worldview, which is that those gains were artificial anyway.
Yeah, yeah. At this point, it's just, you know, with every week that goes by, it just becomes harder and harder to believe that we're going to spike back up there by natural means, I guess, for lack of a better term, you know?
Well, another question is, why won't they just turn this Tether printer back on? The only yeah. problem with this Tether printer is that it's been out of ink for too long.
Yeah, well, that's another thing that I don't quite get, which is that, like, if you are a shady exchange and you are operating, you know, a little bit outside of the law, but that nobody can really do anything about it, you know? Like, they can't really, like, I don't think anyone from Bitfinex has, like, gone on trial or been put in jail, right? Like, why don't they just keep doing it? Like, they'll find more suckers, you know? Like, it's not like...
Wouldn't the panic be rolling, though? Like, if this had happened, Tether goes to 90 cents, mm-hmm. and then immediately, like, 100 million Tether hit the market, I feel like that would have been when Tether went to 40 cents. Like, at this point, if they turn the printer on at all, I think people are going to probably cry foul. Like, I think probably Tether is cooked at this point in terms of printing new Tethers.
I have a question. Do you feel like this is a broader question that I am curious of what you think. It does seem like right now the entire ecosystem that we bought into, you know, which was Coinbase and then Bittrex and Bitfinex, and then people holding their coins on hardware wallets and, you know, sort of discussing it. It seems like a lot of that is sort of atrophying. Like, do you think that any of that when Bitcoin does come back, which I still think it will at some point, you know, in the next few years.
Yeah, baby. Optimism.
It'll probably come back through a totally different ecosystem, don't you think?
I do. And I'm starting for the very first time when you started talking, but I was like, oh, that's going to be when crypto is like Fidelity crypto, Robinhood crypto. Like, the next wave is not going to be in crypto native apps, I don't think.
But
I think it's going to be crypto invading the
real
world.
Don't you think that kills it? I mean, for me, it kills it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not interested in buying Bitcoin on Robinhood. Like, I would rather buy a spread of marijuana penny stocks and wait for Jeff Sessions to not be like, to not be Attorney General anymore. You know, it's actually more fun.
Jay, to be fair, you can do both.
Yes.
But look, I agree with you, except I want to put one asterisk on that. Nothing in crypto has ever worked out the way I thought it would work out. So probably, however this third wave future works out, whether it's Fidelity and Robinhood or something else, I expect the unexpected. Like, it may be a totally different thing, or it may end up having really different parameters. Like, it's quite possible that crypto could become a Fidelity product in which people invested in what are basically early stage technology projects through tokens that are all managed through some sort of a like brokerage. Am I like as excited about that as living in a vegetable-less steak wasteland? No. I think it's more wild and fun to imagine these like extremist futures.
But what function does crypto serve in that then? Like, why not just use the dollar?
It's a fair question. I would say it probably serves the function of allowing people to do things that are on the very edge of legal. But almost nothing that's worked in crypto so far hasn't been people doing things on the very edge of legal.
Yeah.
Like, well, the real success cases are like gambling and like
drugs,
maybe certain drugs and like a kind of functional prediction market.
Passports. Yeah.
Yeah. Jay, just as a quick side note, you'd be amazed to find out how many people have pitched that they want to come on the show to talk about their new stablecoin during the week in which stablecoins were crashing to the ground, and none of the pitches addressed this.
Don't you think they're doing that on purpose, though? Because they want to all sort of hop in right now. Like, right now, the king is dead, you know? It needs to be replaced by somebody.
Yeah. Well, none of them got a response. But, like, you were talking to me before we got going about, like, kind of the idea that maybe there's something bigger behind the scenes happening.
Yeah, well, I think that what there's probably happening right now, and I use the term probably very, very loosely here, perhaps happening in my own imagination happening is that
allegedly
there is probably some economy that is running on some sort of cryptocurrency that nobody knows about right now that is totally illegal and only used for illegal activities, and that in its own way is much more anonymous and much more sexy and a little bit more dangerous than Bitcoin or any of the coins that we know right now. And I imagine that eventually we will hear about this thing and that it will become sort of the, you know, cool face of crypto. The thing that we've talked about in the past. And
hey, it's called Monero. Come on.
I don't think it is Monero, though. as the months pass and, you know, we're at this flatline part, the one thing I'm having a harder time figuring out is if the future of Bitcoin is through like Fidelity or through E-Trade or through like Charles Schwab, you know, like what's the point of it? Like, why would people get excited about it? You know, it's just another thing to invest in that, you know, will, because of its association with those places, be way more stable, and it'll just be like buying like, you know, like GE stock or something like that or whatever. I just think that maybe the story of crypto, instead of being a revolutionary technology that takes over the world, might actually just be a story of a series of illegal ways to make digital money to sort of fund dark markets or money laundering. And that once it's discovered, people get excited about it, it's regulated to hell or made illegal, and then it just comes back in another form, like over and over and over again. That's sort of my idea about it.
All right, let me make a counter idea. I don't know why I'm riding for Fidelity here, but I'm going to ride for Fidelity. So, like, what's the biggest wealth creator in the last couple decades for investors? I would say if buying tech stocks was about as well as you were going to do. Like, if you've just,
I guess so. Like, if you're talking about, like, stable ways to make a lot of money.
I'm just saying, if you just were, like, a shitcoin and Bitcoin buyer in the United States tech markets, IPO tech markets, you did extremely well over the last 25 years. It's just been like pretty good times. And
sure,
the people in Silicon Valley right now are making even more money than that by basically privately investing their wealth into new ventures. So
yeah,
if there's a way that moving the primary crypto world to Fidelity makes sense, I believe it's in shortening the distance between investors and these extremely lucrative technology startups and companies that are probably going to swallow a lot of the world's money in the next 25 years.
Not just money, but also like attention.
Attention.
Artistic output.
Power.
Soul.
Like human data. Governments. Probably.
Oh, okay. So, like, just philosophically then,
sure,
right? One thing that I'm interested in is that, like, it's become much, much more clear to me in the past 6 months or so since I stopped working at Vice that My future is going to be some combination of working for one of these big tech companies. It doesn't matter which one,
sure.
But it'll either be Google through YouTube, or it'll be Amazon or Apple.
Netflix.
Yeah, Netflix. Any of those things are...
Shouts out to our friend Doug Kim's show on Facebook Watch. Check that one out.
Yeah. Well, I guess my point being, and I don't think that, you know, I feel somewhat agnostic towards that, because I think that, you know, in the past, there are also conglomerates mm-hmm. called networks and things like that, and they might actually have worse politics than the current things. However, the idea of crypto needs to push against that a little bit, and it needs to be an alternative. And when you talk to, you know, when you and I like are negative about the price of Bitcoin, but I don't think that we're particularly negative about the promise of all crypto projects.
No, I think we actually crowned, and we'll revisit this on New Year's, but so far I think we crowned Bitcoin maximalists as the winner of 2018.
Yeah, or even like when we talked to Tony Hsiang, you know, like there's no doubt that that guy is extremely smart, very creative.
Yeah, he had a couple really good pieces recently. Subscribe to his newsletter. Yeah. It's good stuff. You're not going to do better in reading about crypto.
No, I don't think so either. And he's somebody who really does believe in these projects. And, you know, I would not count him out. And I don't think he would be doing it if the whole thing was folly. But for it to be interesting, right, it kind of needs to stand outside of that growing monolith that everybody is facing. You know, like if you and I could put, like, instead of running this podcast through Apple or Spotify, if you and I could do something where there was a different business model that didn't give money to those companies, we would probably do it, you know, like just because of our personalities and what we believe in general. And I think that the closer Bitcoin and crypto gets to companies like Fidelity, the harder it is for that to happen.
Well, I think Tony Hsiang might agree with you, like insofar as he had a piece last week that was about the first like killer way that crypto would be adopted within a truly like mass form. Would be for like in-app purchases and games. Like if items in Fortnite, say, were tracked on some sort of a blockchain in which they were bought and sold, and basically a economy the size of Fortnite, which is massive, were to be built on top of crypto, that would not only be the furthest that crypto has like penetrated into mass consciousness, it would also be bigger than all of the other crypto stuff combined.
Yeah, I'm actually curious about that. Why a company like Activision or a company like Riot Games or whoever doesn't, you know, with League of Legends, which I think is still the biggest game, even bigger than Fortnite still.
You love League of Legends.
I've never played League. I actually don't even understand.
What's that, fantasy card game that you showed me? What's that called?
Oh, Hearthstone?
Hearthstone. That's the
I play Hearthstone a ton.
That Hearthstone is much more achievable in some sort of a blockchain format, I think, than a Fortnite, because it's not like super fast. It's just cards.
Yeah, but at the same time, way more money is spent on Fortnite, you know?
I mean, that game's huge though. I mean, look, it's going to take a hit, and I don't think the hit is going to be a pre-crypto hit with crypto tacked on. I think what Tony Hsiang, he can correct me if I'm wrong, is talking about is something more profound, which is like a game built from scratch from crypto world.
Oh yeah, no. I this is the first I'm hearing about this idea, but no.
Jay, let me explain this idea to you that you haven't read the article of that I keep citing different parts of.
No, but I mean, just broadly, you know, I think you and I do agree about this, which is that the ways in which you and I work on culture or cultural production are we're like dinosaurs, you know, and maybe we'll win in the end and not go extinct. But the real culture that is insurgent right now is not like young people trying to do us. It's actually just young people in gaming culture.
Yes, for the most part. The closest I feel like we're plugged into like non-dinosaur culture is that we're just two guys sitting around commenting on a bunch of shit, not actually doing anything. That's our most youthful quality, Jay.
Yeah, I know.
And we don't know, also, and we don't really know what we're talking about, but we're still willing to just talk about a topic for an hour without even basically informing ourselves.
I play like a lot of video games too, so that's part of it. But playing something, you know, I've started playing a lot of Overwatch, which is another huge video game, you know.
Sure.
And the second that you kind of slide into those cultures and those microeconomies, you get a sense of how huge they are and like all the ways in which people are spending money. And so I guess I kind of agree with Tony, which is just that at some point somebody is just going to say, hey, we can actually profit more than by funneling all this money through like PlayStation's PS, like, you know, dollar buy token system, or, you know, Nintendo has its own thing, right, where you buy like Nintendo credits or something like that. And we can actually just create a functional cryptocurrency that maybe you can use across games, that maybe you can use in different ways. And, you know, there were some cryptocurrencies that tried to be that. Do you remember that? Like, remember, I think you and I both own game credits coin.
There's 100 people who have emailed us trying to do something along these lines. If you're listening now and you're thinking, oh, that's what I'm doing, I should send Aaron and Jay an email to tell them about it. Save yourself the email.
Yeah,
we know.
I think the difference being, and this is what I imagine Tony was saying, was that you can't retroactively put a coin into an existing ecosystem. You have to build the game that is going to be wildly popular around the coin and force people to use that coin within that ecosystem. And that makes a ton of sense to me.
I think that's like, so like a lot of where he went with this topic, and I think he's right, is that right now, like, you have this massive economy in Fortnite of people buying like skins, but
skins,
there's no
yeah.
resale market for skins and they can't be transferred, which is a huge hindrance on the, like,
I think you can sell your account.
You can sell your account, which is done on the black market, and it's a TOS violation. So it's sort of like a gray area tolerated policy. And so you can buy rare things by buying the accounts that they live with, but it's basically a hacky, non-first rate solution that means that there's a cap on how much value really can be imbued into these rare items. And where I think it gets into crypto is not just, oh, it's powered by a blockchain. It's like, yeah, there's like rare items that are going for over $1 million. They can be transferred anonymously using like smart contracts and escrow. And you're no longer talking about collecting Yeezys and rare Nikes. You're collecting rare suits that you can wear in some game. And it gets to the point where most of the people aren't even playing the game. They're just trading the fashion of the game.
Yeah, which is what happens now. I mean, without skins, I feel like me at the age of 38, I'm largely impervious to this sort of stuff. Like, I don't care. But I will say that, like, a couple of weeks ago, I was playing Overwatch, and I got, like, the Dick Tracy McCree skin, which is, like, a legendary skin for one of the Overwatch characters. And it was, like, very, very, very exciting to me. So I get it a little bit. But, yeah, I mean, look, if you put that type of stuff on the blockchain, you can also do things like establish uniqueness, right? Like, you can
sure.
you can just have one of them. And it doesn't have to be something that's accessible to everybody and can have proof that that thing is real and that it's yours and that it's, you know, has a certificate of authenticity from the game maker, et cetera, et cetera. And then the value of all of that goes up, you know, probably bad for society, but also very interesting for like a game economy.
Well, I mean, already we're seeing an economy in Fortnite that has become more valuable than the market for charging $60 a game to just simply give people a game and just sell skins.
By the way, have you heard about this? The new Assassin's Creed has this new microeconomy thing that nobody has really seen before. The game is like an open world thing, and there's all these stupid side missions that are boring, and everybody complains that like it's impossible to advance in the game. And the reason why they did it is because as part of their offerings for microeconomy stuff, they allow you to skip large parts of the game that you bought to play.
Hey, baby. Any way it works.
Like, we know this is long and torturous, but, you know, here, how about, like, you know, we'll speed you up a little bit.
I think where I was going with that was just that Fortnite as a game where the money comes from selling items is already closer to the crypto future than a console game that you buy on a disc. And as we get further and further there, I just, at a certain point, I agree with you, like, I'm surprised we haven't already seen these games, and like, we're definitely going to be talking about this in the next 2 years, right? Someone's already pretty deep
into
this.
I think that's part of what Tony is doing, right, with his Ethereum.
Well, Decentraland could be seen as a Sims meets that website 1 million pixels, where that guy sold all the like land on his website.
Yeah,
kind of idea. I think about that maybe once a week for some reason.
Yeah, I think that. Or do you know that game VR Chat where people just like make weird avatars and walk around and talk to each other? It's kind of like Second Life, but even more rudimentary.
I have to admit, this is more your area of expertise than mine. I am consistently shocked at the kinds of weird video game shit you get into.
Yeah, look, I'm trying to adjust so that I'm not left behind as an extinct in the nuclear winter that's coming to all of us in dinosaur media.
Do you Twitch cast yourself playing games, right?
No,
you don't.
No, I had a day where I.
You did once.
I think this is a good idea, and I think I'll keep doing it once I'm a little bit further. But I thought it would be, and honestly, my publisher will probably not go for it, so I might not do it. But I was going to.
Oh, you were doing it with your book.
Yeah, I was going to like Twitch cast myself writing my book, and I was not going to not that so many people would know who I was, but I was going to just like make it. You know, not announce it in any sort of way, which I guess now is not, but thankfully, like, you know, no one listens to this podcast. but I was just going to kind of see if I could build up an audience organically on Twitch of people who weren't like media people like that. Like, you know, you and I both know that, like, if I got 3 or 4 friends to tweet it out, then for like 2 days, I might have like an audience of like 200 people, which isn't a lot at all, but that some people in media would be interested in that project. But I was going to see if I could just do it without that, you know, because there are people who write books on Twitch. Actually, there are quite a bit, but they're mostly like kind of fantasy type books, you know? So I thought about that, but yeah.
All right. Should we talk about Civil?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So going back, we had Maria Bustillos. I feel like I heard about Civil backwards. We had Maria Bustillos on the show talking about her publication, Popula, which is built on top of Civil. And Civil itself is a consensus project. Consensus, our guest last week, Nick Palmgarten, Consensus headquarters appears in his New Yorker story. They're out in Bushwick in this kind of like industrial lofty building. And it's Joe Lubin, who's a founder of Ethereum's money. And actually, I thought quite presciently in the story, Palmgarten sort of asked the question of Joe Lubin, is Consensus all basically a big way to pump your Ethereum holdings? He is the world's largest Ethereum holder. And he was like, no, that's absurd. You know, what a like ridiculous way of trying to make money that would be, which is kind of like, I'm like, yeah, but again, with that question. So somewhere up the chain, like we met Maria Bustillos, who is a great writer and editor. And she's like the human face of something that's a long chain that stretches all the way up to the top of the Ethereum ladder.
Sure.
Is that important to the story? Not really. So they started getting ready to publish. I didn't even realize when we were first talking about it that Civil was like going to be something that was for sale. I just thought it was like some kind of Ethereum journalism scheme. Did you realize it was going to be for sale?
Yeah, I did, because she explained it to us on the podcast that we did with her. I'm not sure if you were listening.
It wasn't for sale then. I guess it didn't seem like it was like the sale was a big deal because it hadn't happened yet, and it like you couldn't buy it.
No, you definitely could not buy it yet. And no, they didn't really have that much information on how it was going to be distributed or whether it was going to be on exchanges or not, you know, like whether you could buy this thing on Bittrex or whatever.
So whether it's a token sale or an ICO, whatever you want to call it, the goal was to sell up to $34 million, I think was the max, in tokens using a variable pricing scheme. I think they were like priced between 27 and 92 cents. So I have to admit, naively, when I heard about this, I was like, oh, wow. Well, that's strange, but it'll probably work. Like, people buy, like, all kinds of bullshit. They'll probably buy this. Right?
Yeah. I mean, but maybe not anymore. Maybe it was a timing thing.
I think that's what I would be thinking if I was them. I think, to their credit, I would be like, woo, couldn't have landed at a worse time.
It was a bad time.
It's just as, like, yeah. Ethereum was bottoming out, and also, like, people like Vitalik were saying, like, price doesn't even matter. And it was just kind of like, I'm going to buy. Because you had to, I mean, the other part I didn't really see coming was how hard it was going to be for people to buy these tokens who were normal people, which I should have seen because we're normal people. And it's taken us forever to be able, even able to do basic stuff like get Ethereum into MetaMask. So they're hit with a double whammy of, wow, this is kind of a shitty time to want to buy Ethereum. And also, it's really hard to then trade that Ethereum into CVL tokens.
Yeah, and I think that there was also this fundamental miscalculation in which I kind of get what the, and look, this is pure speculation. Nobody said this, but I imagine that what they were trying to do was to get some very influential or somewhat influential people in media with large social media followings on Twitter or whatever to discuss this thing, to get the public excited about it, but to also get the types of people who have invested in other coins excited about it, not because they believe that the people who are tweeting about it matter, but almost as sort of like reverse engineered, well, if that person is tweeting about it, then more suckers are going to be into it or more people will know about it, and therefore I should buy into it too. That type of thing, you know? And I just don't know if, you know, and this is something that happens a lot in our business outside of crypto, which is that, like, it's a very, 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 very bad bet to bet on media people and their Twitter accounts. Like, you can't base anything on it. And we've seen the failure of everything from, you know, certain news organizations that were sprouted up in the past 5 years to, you know, all sorts of things. Like, the media Twitter does not matter. It is an ecosystem unto itself full of shit. And the idea that it would help promote a coin, like, I get what the idea was behind it, but, you know, I wish they had come and asked you and me about it, Aaron, because we would have told them, listen.
I think they did ask us about it, didn't they?
Like, in a more private moment, they would have been like, listen, like, you know, should we rely on these people? Like, is that going to actually help? And I'd be like, listen, there is nothing that media Twitter has ever helped.
I'm not so sure that they really thought that this was going to go down with media Twitter. My assumption was that they were like, you look at the banana coins and the denta coins of the world finding buyers, and you're like, how could this, like, decently well thought out real thing with an office and ties to consensus and legit people-ish behind it, more so in the journalism world than the, like, crypto world. I'm not sure people in the crypto world know who any of these people are. But, you know, it doesn't seem like a terrible bet. The part where it breaks down for me isn't the lack of, like, influencers. It's that I would never try to sell a new coin to a bunch of people who've never bought any coins before. Like, I would always rather be the project that, like, the guy who buys ICOs, this is his 19th buy, is into, than Civil. Yeah. Seemed like it was trying to appeal to a first-time crypto buyer, whether they're from the journalism world or Silicon Valley or wherever.
But that's what I mean. Like, I just, that's why I was saying that I think it was more, from what I know about ICOs, and you and I did some research on them at the time when we were going to invest in them, and thank God we didn't. But, yeah, okay. I mean, it depends how early on we're talking about in our, like, 17 separate attempts to.
I mean, it's possible that we would have gone, like, 100x and then lost, like, 98 of those x, but still be 2x, depending on what we bought.
Yeah. That is true. Or there's a chance that you and I would have like USB drives full of garbage that we paid a lot of money for.
Or we would have ended up with like being like Ian Bellina and we'd be like faking getting hacked on the air.
Yeah, exactly. Well, okay. So when Ian Bellina was a more influential part of our lives, like you and I looked at a lot of ICOs and I think we came to the same conclusion, which is that almost all of them were bullshit,
yes.
Right? And that the way that they tried to hook people into it was to give some reason why other people would be excited about this thing. Not necessarily saying why this thing was revolutionary, why it was amazing, but like, hey, there's going to be a little bit of hype about this for this reason,
yeah.
Right? That's why you have like Floyd Mayweather and Paris Hilton and Steven Seagal and all these celebrities.
I mean, the Floyd Mayweather DJ Khaled one was literally a fraud. Those dudes are in jail now, Centra.
Yeah, no, but that's what I mean. Like, it's just like, how do you build
yeah.
hype? And I do think that if you ask the people who were behind this, that they would probably say that they didn't really expect at the very beginning for a lot of the investors to be, you know, readers who like the work of Tom Skoka or any of the journalists who are involved in any of this, that they would expect that the types of people who buy ICOs would see that real people, and, you know, these are all real
yeah.
journalists, and a lot of them are very good journalists. Actually, I would say, I don't know anyone who was involved in Civil who I would not say was a good journalist. You know,
there's also dozens and dozens of newsrooms. I mean, it's already, before it was even funded, has already made itself into a sprawling apparatus.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is
so
to me
like,
a little bit of like a whoa, like I don't maybe we should have done this in the opposite order kind of a question. But
well, that's what I mean. So it's like your question of like okay, like we already empirically we know that like the people who buy ICOs will buy anything as long as you know. So why wouldn't they just buy this thing that is more real, that has real people attached to it?
I have a hot take. It's too real. Like
I actually agree with you.
It is
yeah.
to your disadvantage to have a real product here. I think the realer, the better written, the more thought out, the more that a rational person can read what it says and criticize it, the worse. Like they did too good a job.
Yeah, it was too real. Yeah. They could have just been like, you know, do you hate the news? You know, here's the fake news coin and that's it. You know, like that literally, and then cut and paste a bunch of different white papers in it and just been like, this is an inner layer, like, solution to such and such and such. Like that would have been, that might have been better. Maybe it was too real. Like maybe they went through it in too good faith.
I mean, it's a little strange that there was already real publications on it that you could go see. That's unusual for an ICO.
Yeah, and some of those publications are good. Like there's some good, there's good writing on these things. Like, you know, maybe it is too real.
I would expect someone selling a journalism ICO to ICO buyers. Here's how I'd pitch it. I would be like, it's uncensorable media, like media newsrooms that you can fund based on your own beliefs. That is like how crypto people think about this. They don't think about it in terms of like micro tipping your favorite, like nonfiction prose stylist.
Yeah, or like, or you could just make it totally insurrectionary and be like, you know, every dollar that you invest into this is somehow like leeching money out of the New York Times or something like that. You know?
Well, I think there's a very realistic, if you really looked at like what publications would be funded by their readers using some sort of a decentralized token, you very quickly end up in like Daily Stormer territory. Like that's the
yeah.
audiences that are like majority crypto to begin with. The audience for this project seems like they're all like Ethereum. What? I get a Coinbase account and then I transfer it to my MetaMask
yeah.
and it's like, okay.
Yeah. And also they're like, isn't crypto bullshit?
Yeah. It's not a,
like, that's their first question.
It's not a judgment. I'm not like, oh, they made the wrong choice by trying to do high quality work and do something real. I applaud them. Everyone I know who is an interesting, smart person in crypto, I haven't heard a single person be like, I wish Civil ill. I think they should be lauded for the nobility of their vision. And we should note that that vision is currently incongruous with Ethereum ICO maneuvers.
Oh, yeah. And here's the other thing, which is that it could have just been bad timing. It could have been the fact that like the launch didn't work, you know, And what ended up happening, for those who don't know, is that Consensus had to buy like 82% or something like that of the coins that didn't sell.
I think they had, they put in like a $500,000 buy to sort of juice the market. And then that was reported, which was even like, I feel like, further dampening the market, because it was like, we're not going to make it. And even what we have was kind of phony.
Yeah, it was not real.
And they're giving up. That's the end of that story.
And they're giving... They gave the money back, they refunded it, and they're going to try again to do a sale with it, with a sort of mechanism to distribute coins that's a little easier, right? And I guess, like, I would just say that my general thought about this is that I at first I was very doom and gloom about it, but, you know, I think I've come around to something that you said a few weeks ago, which is that it's actually probably a positive story for crypto that you and I, who are inside this world and know all these people, can at least vet, we can at the very least vet the sincerity of the products that were being put out there. Like, Maria Bastillos was not trying to capitalize on, like, some scam moment.
Yeah.
You know, like, the people who wrote the pieces, which are for civil publications, were not trying to capitalize on a scam moment. They weren't trying to scam the public. It just didn't work because we're at an early phase of all of this. And I think you're right in the end. I think that the problem that they had was that they played it too close to the vest, you know? Like, if they had gone in full scam mode, they probably could have figured out some bullshit way that this thing could have worked. But it is a little bit distressing that so much of the market doesn't exist, you know, that they fell this short of it. And I think that probably says something about the health of crypto and what people think about crypto more than civil itself.
Can I say one negative thing? I've tried to keep it positive here, and I applaud their vision. But when I got that Instagram ad that was like, you can now buy CVL with fiat, I was like, oh, they did go low. Like, this, it's not like they didn't pull out all of the stops and like try to sell it like a scammy ICO. Even when they did that, the market didn't really budge. And additionally, I do feel like when I read like that Joshua Benton piece in Neiman Labs and some of the more skeptical coverage, I feel like there's a little bit of like, you can't like drop all this kind of like vague language and expect journalists to just sort of like take all the buzzwords and react positively. Like, this was a hard audience for a product like this. And therefore, they're sort of stuck between the dumbness of crypto and the demands of actually explaining things, which is what someone who like covers the media for someone like Neiman Labs, it's their job to do. So
that's right.
So I guess what I'm saying is it's going to be a lot harder to sell crypto to journalists than it is the rest of the world.
Yeah. And I do wonder how much they thought journalists would buy this stuff. Especially, you know, the other thing is, like, journalists don't have any money.
Yeah, that's one miscalculation. I assume that they were trying to sell it to, like, okay, so you have, like, a Loreen Powell Jobs putting a ton of money into The Atlantic. If you see a successful model for decentralized newsrooms on the civil chain...
Wait, she gave a bunch of money to The Atlantic?
She bought The Atlantic, didn't she? Or she's, like, the new investor?
Oh, good. I'm happy for The Atlantic. They have... They have good journalists there, and it's good that somebody is stabilized.
Well, so here's my point. Obviously, these are not like profiteering like stakes that people are taking into these media companies. I think for the most part, like, rich people take a loss on the media for on average. Certainly, like Chris Hughes did on The New Republic. If
that's a whole other thing, but yes,
if you could show that good work was being done and funded with these tokens, I can see a person taking, let's say, just buying 50% of the civil tokens and holding on to them almost as like an owner of all of this stuff. Like, there are models where someone could become a whale in this ecosystem, or several startup venture kinds of funds could like be like, we're buying a bunch of civil. I mean, that's what's happened with a lot of these crypto projects. Just no one wanted this one.
Yeah. And, you know, maybe they will in the future. I don't know. I mean,
yeah. I mean, look, if this happened during a bull run, do you think it works?
Yeah, I think so. Cause everything works during a bull run. You know, my biggest regret in crypto, Aaron, is that all the funny crypto, you know, funny to us at least, dumb crypto ideas that we had for ICOs at conferences and stuff, We should have just done them during the bull run. We'd be so much richer than we are now.
I feel like that's always the kicker of crypto, though. If you like start planning during the bull run, you catch the like absolute like bear moment by the time you're actually doing it.
You're right. Okay, so what we should do now is that we should be planning our conference right now.
Well, that's also kind of like the social
Con.
ConCon is coming in 2019. If we have to just invite like 9 listeners to come sit on the floor of the crypto cave and listen to us tape, that will be ConCon. But, that's how miners think about this stuff, right? If you're buying mining equipment during a bull run, you're going to get fucking crushed. Mining equipment's super expensive. It's super competitive. If you're buying in a bear market and you get your equipment and it comes online just during that bull run, you do really well. So you're kind of like always timing that cycle. There's some pretty crazy stuff that's come out. I'll let you get out of here in a second. But did you see the stuff about the tariffs on miners under the Trump China deal? Yeah. It's kind of a big deal. 27% tariff on miners. That's totally skewing the economics of mining if you're paying 27% on top of the already very expensive new Bitmain products. Yeah. What do you think this does?
I mean, it probably just means that mining will stay in China, right?
I mean, this whole thing with like Ripple, like where it's like the Trump White House is being pushed towards like Ripple because of threats of like Chinese mining centralization. I realize that's not an actual narrative. That's just something I read on CoinDesk or something, but it's pretty crazy. Or I think Nouriel like tweeted it out or something. But like, I mean, in the war, the mining war between the US and China, it's going to tip pretty heavily towards China if every US miner is paying that tariff.
Yeah. Or if, you know, I mean, the thing that won't happen is that the United States without Chinese labor at all will be able to create a price competitive miner. Like there's no way.
Yep.
So, there's no grassroots option here, you know?
Do you think there could ever be like an American Bitcoin movement where it's like only buy American, like you, I only buy Bitcoin mined in America, or like people,
no.
Or someone just creating a clone of like Bitcoin that's just American Bitcoin?
No. Well, there is a Trump coin, so I imagine that's close to what they were trying to get at.
I mean, but that is what would happen if like our like economies were really deep in Bitcoin, is that people would be wanting to create like crypto variants that were more advantageous to their own like national situation, right?
Yeah, well, like the ruble Ethereum or whatever is coming.
And whatever happened to that Bolivar coin?
I don't know. I honestly, like, Venezuela at this point seems so much like, you know, like the novel that would be written about that type of political situation, that I can't even tell what's going on there anymore. I mean, it's just insane.
I feel like these weird like holes of history open up like Venezuela right now. And on one level, I'm like, that could be the beginning of the like Bitcoin takes over all of these developing economy story. Or it could be like, and then Venezuela and Bitcoin both vanished from the earth.
Yeah, no, I think it's either going to be one of the two.
All right, Jay, this has been a pleasure. I'll see you next week.
Yep.
Later.
This episode of Coin Talk was taped Friday, October 19th at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Bitcoin price index was $6,433.
Hey, thanks for listening to Coin Talk. This episode was edited by James Nicholson. Our partners are over at Medium. You can find all of our episodes at medium.com/cointalk. You can also find transcripts over there. And you can also send us an email, hi@cointalk.show. We love to hear from you. We love sponsors, and we'll be back soon.